Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm going to start my stopwatch here. Okay, so I'm here to talk to you today about thinking outside the 2x2 table and aggregating case exposure data for use in outbreak investigations. My name is Hillary Booth. I'm the lead foodborne research analyst at the Oregon Public Health Division, and I coordinate the Oregon Center of Food Safety Excellence. And our name is the Northwest Center for Foodborne Outbreak Management, Epidemiology, and Surveillance, or affectionately known as FOMEES. So what we're going to talk about today, we're going to do a little bit of a review about foodborne outbreak methodology during investigations, a little case control, talking about binomial probability calculations and how those also can be used during foodborne outbreak investigations, and a brief description of the evolution of the shotgun hypothesis generating questionnaire data collection process in Oregon over the past decade, and a brief update on Project Mercury, more about that to come. So foodborne disease surveillance, Salmonella, E. coli 0157, and Listeria infections are all nationally reportable, and they're typically investigated at the state or local level. Most states are doing molecular serotyping and subtyping to determine which cases match as potential clusters, and states and sometimes CDC work to detect and investigate these outbreaks together and sometimes separately. Outbreaks are historically investigated via case control study, I would say historically for quite a few decades, and that's been sort of sitting around as the gold standard for a while, and we're talking about maybe reconsidering that a little bit. So, case control issues. Case control studies can be lengthy and resource intensive. If anybody went to Rachel Jervis's talk, you would know that it may take quite a few phone calls to get a case if you're doing random digit dialing, and it improves a little bit better if you have geographically specific phone lists for your interviewers to call. Interviewers may be doing these interviews a little bit far outside of the onset date, so the ability to recall foods accurately may be diminished. There is an American shift that we need to acknowledge to wireless only or wireless mostly households, and this can make control enrollment very challenging. Anybody that's worked on FoodNet in the past 7 or 8 years knows that doing a national case control study can be difficult. We have seen differences between cases and controls with a median age difference of 25 years. So it's a little concerning to try and say that those are comparable populations. Also, case control studies are still very necessary at times, so I don't want to say that we should never do them. but sometimes you may not need to, and that's what we're going to explore. One thing to point out also as well is that case control studies can be good if we are looking to deal with a high-frequency food that we're suspecting. Sometimes the binomial model may not pick that up as easily and give you a signal to look at it. So a fresh approach. Binomial probability calculations started happening in Oregon around 2003 when we instituted a standardized hypothesis generating questionnaire, commonly known as the shotgun. We use this to detect a binomial probability score, and we compare those kinds of hits that we see and explore traceback on these items to see if they converge. This helps us do rapid food identification during cluster investigations. Hypothesis generating questionnaires also have become standardized at the national level, meaning that there's a questionnaire that's available to every state to use, as well as CDC during investigations where we are looking to do binomial probability calculations. And also, some of you might know that the EpiInfo app now features a binomial calculation tool for you to use on the go. So let's talk a little bit more about binomial probability calculations. They're also known as Bernoulli trials, and there are typically two possible outcomes for each trial. So we're talking about male versus female, under five or not, or in the case of a foodborne investigation, possibly ate the cantaloupe or didn't. The probability of success in this formula is defined as P, failure is 1 minus P, and P is held constant for all trials, so it's independent. And when we're assessing the exposure histories that we collect with the shotgun HGQ, we're doing these kinds of calculations. So the question we're asking is, by chance alone, how likely are we to find X of N people or more eating a given product? And here's the formula that we like to use here. You can see N is number of cases, X is number of cases who ate product. And most importantly, I would say for this talk, P equals the background consumption rate. So just the slide here from Rachel's talk, just comparing, she showed a population-based case control study where they had 11 of 12 cases reporting eating ground beef, and they had about 35 controls they had to make, 35 calls they had to make for each control enrollment, which left them with an odds ratio of 11 and a p-value of 0.04. They ran these both using background estimates for salmonella. With Oregon case data, they used background ground beef estimates and ran the binomial calculation, and they got a probability that was pretty low. They also looked at the Food Net population survey data for ground beef, and they also got a pretty significant binomial probability score. So that was just showing that it might be possible to do both of these things in this situation, particularly if resources are scarce. So here's a slide from Dr. Craig Hedberg that I've borrowed. He retrospectively went back and looked at a case control study they had done among cases in Minnesota, and it was associated with eating Schwann's ice cream. So when they did their first study, they had a matched odds ratio of 2.5, and that was for eating any ice cream. But as you see, there's not a significant finding in this. P is 0.2. When they had a more specific hypothesis they were looking at, Schwann's ice cream, the case rate was still pretty high, but the control consumption rate went down, and it was easier to find a higher odds ratio of 10, and the p-value was significant. What Dr. Hedberg did retrospectively is take a look at the population survey and plug in numbers, and found that Minnesota residents ate ice cream at 62.6% according to the POP survey, and that means the binomial probability would have been 0.04 for this investigation. So what does this mean? Well, this graph is showing the relationship between the number of controls and the p-value. So 13 out of 15 cases were exposed in this case, and we'll say 60% of controls were exposed to eating ice cream. As you can see, the blue line is telling you that the number of controls per case is associated with the p-value, and it's coming in right at about 5. So you need 5 controls enrolled per case to get a significant p-value when you have 60% of your controls exposed to the food item, whereas the binomial probability is a straight 0.04 across the board, so it was significant. So where do we get sources of background rate estimates? Well, to be fair, we get a lot of them from the FoodNet POP survey. This is a multi-wave study, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out that in my abstract I said that the latest POP survey was 2006 and 7, and that no further ones were planned, but as many of you have heard throughout this conference, they are planning a new wave of the POP survey in 2016, so we're very excited to see that updated. We also could look at USDA nutrition surveys, market share data for food and other kinds of products that we're interested in, educated guesses, restaurant sales records, and what we are interested in this talk is aggregated case surveillance data. So we're going to take a look just quickly at the listeriosis outbreak associated with caramel apples. So this was reported, there were 28 cases in 10 states. Oregon did not have a case when this was initially reported, and we didn't in the end either. 26 out of 26 were hospitalized, and they had 5 deaths. So this was clearly a situation where a rapid response was indicated. By the time that they had contacted us, and I think by the time they had posted it on the web at first, they had already come up with a hypothesis about caramel apples. An astute interviewer was able to capture this information across multiple interviews and had a signal to follow up on it. But we were wondering, and they were as well, could they use a binomial probability calculation on this outbreak instead of launching a case control study that may be resource intensive and lengthy? So they queried Oregon, and they also queried Minnesota, I believe, who also had a case in the investigation. And they looked at FoodNet POP survey data as well to try and get a proxy for caramel apples, because none of us were really asking about those specifically. So we figured that a caramel apple, a proxy for that would be apples, and that would be a much higher rate and would bias us away from the null. So when we talked about this, there was a range of 47 to 53% of our cases in Oregon that had reported eating apples in the 7 days prior to illness. This would include salmonella and E. coli 0157 cases, 734 of them. We also had additional detail we could offer from 249 cases about specific apple types. And this is because we've revised our questionnaire a bit to include more specific details that we can capture in a quantitative way. So as you can see, the most popular apple in Oregon is apparently the Fuji, followed next by Gala, and Jonah Gold is just not very popular, I guess. Macintosh was less than one for any of you New England people wondering. So here's the final posting to the web that CDC put up related to the Listeria outbreak. And there were a total of 35 people that were infected with the strains. And the cool part down here is that they had data, 28 out of 31 people reported eating commercially produced prepackaged caramel apples. So that's pretty high. But what does that mean in the context of regular background consumption? Well, for those of you who haven't seen this before, this was Dr. Bill Keane's template that he used to do binomial probability calculations on the fly. So this isn't this is just a regular spreadsheet where you plug in numbers. So in this instance, we would put in the sample size was 31, and we estimate maybe the background rate, if we're very conservative, for apples would be 60%. This line I'll show you here, that if 28 people report eating these apples, it's a pretty slim chance that this happened by chance alone, I would say. We have a pretty low score. So when we use this spreadsheet, it's nice. We like it. No one has a problem with using the spreadsheet. But what if we could use it for all of the items at the same time and not have to plug them in individually? That's kind of where we went with this. And this project has been going on for quite a while. Since the questionnaire started in 2003, there have been at least three iterations of the data system that accompany it. So the questions we were asking are, how could we optimize our shotgun hypothesis generating data collection and analysis while also aggregating the responses that we get from cases? Additionally, how could we streamline binomial calculations during outbreak investigations? And are Oregon's case exposure data background estimates similar to the ones that Minnesota posted recently for their salmonella cases? And are they similar to the ones posted for citizens or population people in the FoodNet Pop survey? So this bore a project we call Project Mercury. And for those of you who are not familiar with where this title originated, Mercury on the periodic table is HG. For hypothesis generating. Also, Dr. Hagberg is enjoying the metaphor that Mercury is the expedient winged messenger to the gods, and maybe we can consider that for what it is. So Project Mercury in Oregon started out with really a complete overhaul of our data system. So our system now allows us to spit out a custom hypothesis generating questionnaire on demand. We have a standardized exposure library that I'll come back to. We have facilitated rapid data entry. So this system is set up where you only enter the yes or the maybe answers, which are definitely not the majority of responses you get with these questionnaires. So it's much faster than entering the no's. And we have exposure frequency analysis built into the report that you can run after you enter your data. Additionally, we do case-case comparisons using binomial calculations on the back end with all of the data that we've aggregated into the system. So here's a shot of our exposure library. On the left-hand side here, you can see we have unique identifying codes for each of these items. And that's really important for this system. I can't stress this enough. It is all about these unique exposure codes. Without them, it's really difficult to make any of these things happen. We have a separate way that we track variable names in the database so we can use them more easily during export. And then we have different sections. The sections are actually independent of data entry or analysis. They're really built so we can organize the questionnaire and make it have a better flow during the interview. So here's a little shot of what our data looked like. We ended up segmenting our data because we felt that the questionnaires collected during the first time period before we changed the system were a little bit different. So period A is the first generation shotgun HGQ, and this is the one that's been in circulation for quite a while. There aren't that many sub-questions. There are a few questions that have a little bit more detail, like type of milk or whether you had a brand of peanut butter, but for the most part, it's quantitative and yes, maybe no format. Then we also, in this time period, these were interviews that we included from 2007 to 2012. And cases are only cluster associated during this time period, meaning we're only interviewing them with the shotgun when we detected them as part of a PFG cluster. And then we did retrospective aggregation for these cases, which is a little bit tricky. And if you're interested in hearing more about that, I could probably wax on that forever. There are some tricky things to consider when you're talking about food in general and when you're talking about food retrospectively even more so. Period B for us was the second generation of the Shotgun HGQ, and for this one we've implemented a skip pattern that allows people to capture detail and skip through many questions. So for example, we used to have a question about, did you have any whipped cream from a carton? Did you have any whipped cream from a can? Did you have any Cool Whip? And for someone that says, I didn't have any whipped cream, when you ask them the first question, it can get a little annoying to do that. But we want to probe. We always want to probe. So we left those on there because we want to be able to capture them. But we now have a parent-child situation where we can say, did you have any whipped cream? Oh, yes, you did. Well, what kind of whipped cream did you have? Interviews in this period B were conducted between 1-1-2013, and I actually pulled these data shortly before I left. So they were as of May 27th. And in this set, cases are either interviewed as sporadic or cluster-associated. We started interviewing our Salmonella and E. coli 0157 cases on a regular basis based on an eligibility criteria I'll show you in the next slide. And we did also sometimes we would not interview those cases during the eligibility criteria, but we would come back and interview them again if they were identified as part of a cluster. And for this, we were doing prospective aggregation, meaning that our entire system was already mapped to aggregate these data on the back end as these interviews were entered. So here's a little bit of a result for what we got. For period A, we had 26 reported cases of Salmonella and 0157 infection. 33 of those cases were identified as part of a PFG cluster or outbreak, and 21% of those eligible cases were interviewed with the Shotgun hypothesis-generating questionnaire, so a small subset. In period B, we had 1,118 reported cases of Salmonella and 0157, and 61% of those cases were identified as eligible for a Shotgun HGQ interview. And of those eligible cases, 62% were interviewed with that questionnaire. So here's our eligibility criteria. Sorry, that's cutting off there. Sporadic cases are not eligible for HGQ interview if they don't have GI symptoms like vomiting or diarrhea, or if they can't give us a reasonable estimate for the date that these GI symptoms started. The reason being that we asked people about the foods they ate in the 7 days before illness, and if they aren't sure when their illness started, it's difficult to feel confident that we can capture that. We also don't typically shotgun cases that had foreign travel reported in the 7 days prior to onset because we do assume their exposure was likely international. We don't do shotguns for secondary cases because we think that we're probably not interviewing them about their actual exposure. And we're only doing them in English and Spanish right now because these are the speakers that we have on staff. We think that it's a little bit unkind to put somebody through a third-party relay interview doing this questionnaire because there are over 500 questions, and that could take probably 2 hours or more. We don't typically do a shotgun interview if a high-risk exposure was already identified. For example, if we culture a lizard in the home and it matches, we're not going to shotgun them. And typically, if they're already part of an existing outbreak investigation, there's probably a more specific questionnaire that should be used so they don't get the standard HGQ. So I'm going to do very, very brief results about my data set here because that's really not something I would have time to go into. But we'll get into it, and I'll give you an alternative way to get some info. So we identified over 1,150 unique exposures. 288 of those mapped to the 2006-2007 FoodNet POP survey, so we're excited to be able to compare those items. We found differences and similarities across Oregon Period A and Period B. We also found differences and similarities with Oregon Salmonella versus Minnesota Salmonella cases. And then we looked at the Oregon and Minnesota specific rates that were reported in the FoodNet POP survey and compared those to the Oregon and Minnesota case rates and found that, again, some were similar and some were different. So this is a plug for my poster. And the reason being is that you can look at all the data that we were able to pull for this. We had about 13 items of interest we put out there for the first time. So it's in space 191 if you want to look at it. There are also copies of three different versions of the Shotgun there for you to peruse, including the most current one. So here's a shot of what it looks like when we're running a report for an investigation. You can see here we have yeses highlighted, and they're sorted by the frequency. And we have them by variable, name, ID number, and the description is showing on this page. We're doing a binomial probability calculation based on the aggregated data in this set. At the time, all of the data for periods A and B were aggregated together, but they have since been split. So what this is telling us is that we should probably be looking at strawberries in this instance. This was an outbreak data set that we put in after the fact, and it did actually implicate strawberries in the end, but it's a good demonstration of how we use this report. So we had a binomial probability score that was so low that it cuts off, and it's 0.000 on here. We might also be looking at this one down here for farmers markets. This came up as well, and we should probably follow up on that item that is flagged. If you're like me, you're wondering if strawberry consumption is seasonal. So we wanted to try and figure out a way to detect that with these data. So we built in a graphing system that you can pull up for each exposure. So here we have 35% saying yes to strawberries, and we have a breakdown by age. I know those values are small to read, but the biggest group is the 80 plus group on the end, where 50% of them say they eat it. And the smallest group is 40 to 59 year olds, who are reporting 28%. Additionally, we have breakdown by sex. It was 31% for male, 37% for female. And then looking at seasonality here, this highlighted shot is for July and August, where you can see the peak of strawberry consumption. The rates here are 48 and 49%, which, if you remember, is still much lower than what we saw for strawberries at 93% during this outbreak. So that's a bit about the report. I'm going to talk more about the Project Mercury collaboration going forward in my last few minutes here. Basically, we're starting this with outreach to other states that are doing these types of interviews. Technically, most people, I think all states and territories, are doing some kind of interview when they're reported, but they vary from state to state. We're looking to do some data mapping for aggregated exposure data across different sites. And I think it's going to be interesting to look at this in a pathogen-specific way. If you check out the poster, you'll see some differences in consumption just by Salmonella versus 0157. And we're hoping to get some ability to look at more demographic granularity. So can we look at age and sex, maybe even race and ethnicity during these outbreaks? We're going to be working with the Florida Center of Excellence to build a website for public access to these data sets as they emerge, and the supporting materials that document how these data are mapped. And this is just a little demonstration of why this is important. So right now we have 9 sites that are interested in participating. And as we start this project, all of them have databases that are buried deep underground. Some of them are good, some of them are maybe better, depending on what your perspective is. Some people just use Excel spreadsheets that may be harder to aggregate. There's kind of a range of the way that states capture these data, but one thing that's certain is that they're all separate and different. So we have Minnesota, who was able to map, Josh Rounds is in the room here. He was able to map his cases, I believe, from 2009 to 13, and for Salmonella, and they're working on doing that for 0157 infections as well. But what we're able to do in Oregon and Minnesota at this point is sort of liberate our data so people can get a chance to see it in the sunshine. What we're hoping is that as these other sites come on board, and these are all sites that have indicated they are interested in participating in Project Mercury going forward, what we're hoping to do is work to aggregate these data so that during an outbreak investigation, we're able to pick ourselves a beautiful bouquet of data that we can look at. But ultimately, what we're looking for is searchability. It should be these data sets should be easily accessed and searchable for anybody that needs highly contextual information during an outbreak investigation. And we hope that other states will come on board so that this group will get bigger and more representative. So issues to consider. Binomial calculations generate hypotheses. I want to emphasize that. Testing can happen with traceback. You might do some brute force food testing if you have a hypothesis that you think is interesting. We love that in Oregon. Or you might be considering a case control study, which again is sometimes a very applicable thing to do. But again, just to reiterate, these calculations are meant to generate hypotheses that should be followed up on. Again, binomial scores don't pick up high frequency items as well. So if you have a high frequency consumption of milk, for example, you may want to consider a case control study and getting more brand information to inform that study before you conduct it. Case-case comparisons could overestimate certain high-risk food exposures or other exposures that are common to cases of enteric illness. But again, we think that this will bias results away from the null. So bringing it home here, case surveillance data can be aggregated and used in binomial calculations. Rapid binomial calculations can be facilitated by storing background exposure estimates, automating binomial calculations for HGQ items going forward, and we think that the case background data estimates preliminarily are promising, but I think future study will be required to talk about this more. And I think it's interesting what we're doing, but you know, I also think it may be something that other states could consider harnessing their existing case data, because most of us are capturing at least, you know, a subset of high-risk exposures about our Salmonella and 0157 cases. And it's likely that they're very similar questions that are asked across states. Looking forward, we're working to create a range of background exposure rates. So we'll be comparing period A and period B, and we'll be bringing the FoodNet pop survey rates into our system, although that's a little tricky at this point in time because those are weighted estimates. We're still trying to work out the best way to do that. But we would like to have a range to lend validity, to lend validity to this process, and we're hoping that bringing other states in will help us have a wider range to look at during outbreaks that may involve other states. We're very excited, again, to see that the FoodNet pop survey will be continuing in 2016. I think data will probably be available more like 2017-18, but, you know, change is good. Aggregated data on the web, we're looking forward to doing that. We are looking forward to contextualized background rates. And I think there's going to need to be some further study in why we're seeing different rates when we see them. Maybe we're seeing different food trends. Maybe there are regional specificities that we need to look at. But ultimately, it would be nice to compare methodologies across sites. Some sites do online interviews. Some people do them via phone. I think even some might mail them. So it would be interesting to look at that. It's important to acknowledge that this project is the culmination of 10-plus years by Dr. William Keane. And this is a shot that was taken actually the night that he finished the Shotgun 2.0 version. He was very proud of it. So I want to say thank you. And thank you to all these people. And thank you for listening to this talk. So I can take, I think I have 3 minutes left for questions if there are any in the house.
Hi, Hillary. Katie Fullerton with CDCM with waterborne diseases. I spent some time foodborne before that. And I'm curious about the mapping process with between exposure questions across the states, and if you're planning to write up best practices for mapping or ways that you can do it efficiently when you've got different incubation periods, different questions asked in different ways across states by pathogen, et cetera.
Yeah, I definitely think that's something I've learned from the FoodNet case exposure ascertainment project, is that mapping is key, and it can take a while and a lot of revision to get you where you need to be. So I think that just starting out and seeing, just for example, looking at the questionnaires across states will be an interesting starting point, but I do think we're going to have to consider the best practices going forward. You know, we've spent a lot of time considering, more time than I'm actually willing to admit, considering whether a prompted question versus an unprompted question is something that should be aggregated in the same way. So I think we're going to need to look at that as we go, and I think it'll evolve as we start to see what the data looks like. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, thank you.